The following program is brought to you by Podcast One. Recorded live backstage, this is Geffen Playhouse Unscripted. Now here's your host, Rory O'Malley.
Hey guys, Rory O'Malley here, your host for the Geffen Playhouse Unscripted. Thank you so much for downloading and listening. This week, we have an amazing guest. I am so nervous to talk to this actress, Fiona Shaw. She is so incredible. Just, she's done so much, from Medea to Mother Courage to Richard II. She's performed at the National Theatre in London and the Royal Shakespeare Company. And she's also Aunt Petunia from the Harry Potter films. She is currently on AMC and BBC America in the smash hit Killing Eve in its second season, just premiered this week, and you can catch it on Sunday nights. She's as good as it gets as an actress, in my book. So getting to talk with her about the craft and her career was a real treat. This is my conversation with the wonderful Fiona Shaw. Thank you so much for being on our podcast, Fiona. We really love we love having theater artists here, whether they've been at the Geffen Playhouse or not. But you've been in so many different theaters and you've done so much. I'm nervous to talk to you. I'm such a huge fan. I'm so glad that I'm getting to talk to you today because I just watched the premiere of your new show, Killing Eve, the second season, which I binged and just love so much. Tell me a little bit about your experience working on Killing Eve.
Well, it's been like nothing else, I have to say, because I was sent the script whenever we started a year and a half, 2 years ago, and I knew it was wonderful when I read it, but I had no idea. I don't think anyone had any idea it was going to be such a huge popular success. So that's very gratifying. And working on it was marvelous because in the initial weeks that we worked on it, I had lunch with Phoebe and asked her why she wanted me to be in it. And she said because I had played Medea, which she had seen. And I wondered what Carolyn had anything to do with Medea. What way? I'm still puzzling that one out.
Yeah.
But I think it was something about icons. I think she wanted this sense of an iconic person to be the, an iconic character to lead MI6,
right?
Russian desk. So, but of course, the writing couldn't be less like classical theatre writing. It's absolutely understated and therefore has to be underplayed, not in any way like a theatre performance where you're expressing something. This is absolutely about hiding. So
right.
I had a wonderful experience of literally doing the opposite kind of acting to what I normally do.
Right.
And that was a really good exercise. And Phoebe was often present for the first 2 or 3 episodes, and that was just wonderful having her on set and giving us notes and just giving us ideas. And I think she set us on a very good course.
And you had said you weren't familiar before you took this job with her work in Fleabag previously. Is that right?
Funny enough, I went to see it last night.
Oh, you did?
I've just seen Fleabag. No, I mean, I'd heard about Fleabag.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, it was targeted at an audience who are maybe under 30. So I wasn't under 30 enough. But it's been a huge success. And I was delighted to see it last night and cried with laughter on occasion. But I knew about Phoebe, of course. I mean, she's had a fantastically growing reputation for the last few years. So
yeah, she's an incredible talent, and Fleabag is so funny, but still has that bit of drama, you know, that really kind of catches you by surprise, which is why I think she's so perfect for bringing Killing Eve to TV, because you can't believe that you find yourself laughing when people are being brutally killed. But there's a wonderful way of storytelling that she's found, and you all are so perfect together. You are such you are at home on a stage, of course, and you've done so much TV and film, but you're also working on a TV show in this with Sandra Oh, who did, I think, like 72 seasons of Grey's Anatomy. She really pumped out a lot of TV, a lot of television. Did you find that even you yourself, who is so experienced, learning something by working with Sandra Oh, who has just done so many episodes of TV, even if, you know, though you've done so much on stage?
Yes, Sandra is a lesson for any student of television or probably any student of acting. She is one of the most applied people I've ever met. When we were in filming the last season, and indeed this last season, you know, she has a consultatory lesson on a Saturday night. She learns her work very, very far in advance. She scrutinizes the text for anything that in any way doesn't add up, and she is on it, because of course she also plays somebody who has to track thought, and she does that really well. And in that way, Sandra is quite like the character she plays. She's very, very applied and full of an enthusiastic, you know, researcher, detailed concentration. So she is a very, very good lesson for everyone. She and I talk about lots of things actually when we're you know, in between takes. We talk a lot. She would love to have done more theatre, she says. So we talk a lot about the theatre. But it's similar in that to play a leading part in a theatre piece and to play a leading part in a television series as she does, is you shoulder a huge responsibility. And she's very good at that. And I recognise that I don't have to do that quite to the same extent in Killing Eve as she does. So she is very good.
Yeah, and it does take a lot of leadership, and they set the tone for the set, and she does seem to be just completely a ball of energy, and I think that really does affect everyone's performance.
We were just together today at a meeting, and somebody was talking about bad feeling that can emanate from certain performers on theatre or wherever in film. And I said, I'm very keen. I've learned this over the years, that you can get, you know, good actors who have difficult personalities, and you can get good actors who have nice personalities. And it's wiser to take the latter.
Right.
Is that the group dynamic of anything really matters. This is not just the individual performer. It is the group. And the group being buoyant or in good humor with each other pays dividends. And I have to say, on Killing Eve thus far, we have such a group.
That's fantastic. Well, it's an amazing show, and I loved the premiere last night. I was laughing because I start in that episode, I thought, wow, this show is maybe taking a sweet, sensitive turn, and then it quickly changed. I won't spoil anything, but it really tricked me.
Good.
So you'll have to watch the episode, everyone listening, to know what we're talking about. But it's one of the most unique, enjoyable, exciting shows that's on television right now. So definitely check it out. Let's get to where you came from, a little place called Ireland. And yes, as my last name is O'Malley, I have been to Ireland a few times. I love it very, very much. But one thing I haven't experienced in Ireland is a lot of theater. So how did you get into theater and classical theater while growing up in Ireland? Was there a lot of it around you?
Well, Rory, I didn't really. There wasn't a lot growing up while I was growing up there. But my family are mad about performance. My uncle was a great pianist. He was a doctor, actually, but he was a fantastic pianist. My mother's a very good pianist and plays and sings. So we had a large Georgian drawing room, and my mother always had us performing there and at Christmas, etc. I mean, my poor father would have to endure us all rehearsing for months before Christmas. Then he'd have to sit and enjoy the performance on Christmas Day. I had one brother who played the violin, another the flute, and another the piano. And my mother would sing. My mother's mad about singing lumps of opera. And so we were always performing and doing bits of verses. And there was also local competitions, etc. But there wasn't a lot of drama in the town I was brought up in, certainly not professional drama. There was a theatre called the Everyman Theatre, and eventually when I left school I performed there once or twice. But I used to go to the School of Music, where I studied under a marvellous woman called Abby Scott, who I again would just do pieces from things. So it was very piecemeal, really. Mm-hmm. And then at university, there was the university drama, which of course I was addicted to for when I read philosophy at university in Cork, where my parents had been a generation before me. So I was very ensconced in the small town drama, but I knew I wanted to apply for RADA, which would allow me to, I felt I'll never become an actress unless I really, really learn the techniques right. that are necessary. And I wasn't going to just, you know, swank in from the amateur world into, so I applied for RADA, and to my great delight, I mean, one of the greatest delights of my life, I got in.
Wow. Did you have to audition and go there? How did you get in?
I'd go there. I remember there was a brochure, one of those syllabus things came and said things I didn't understand, that you had to have a leotard. I don't think I barely knew what a leotard was. And you had to have a dress that was black to audition in. And I couldn't find a black dress, so I made one. I mean, I was absolutely determined. I sewed it. Now, I hasten to add, I'm not no good at sewing. So because one sleeve was different to the other sleeve. But anyway, I made this dress. I got a plane. My father was very against it, but my mother supported me, and I went and did the audition. And when I got in, my father was very good about it. He'd always said that if I had taken a degree in something, he would always help support me afterwards. So he did. So I got into RADA. I used to go to London and eye the pigeons because I was so hungry. I used to think maybe if I could kill a pigeon, I could eat a pigeon. and he was so hungry. And we just sort of starved. I starved my way through for a bit, and then I, you know, settled into learning to live for the first time as a student away from home.
Wow! Do you feel that getting that degree initially, that wasn't in drama, that actually helped you in your pursuit of becoming an actress?
I think it helped me later when I dealt with very difficult texts.
Right.
I'm not scared of very dense texts, you know.
Right.
I do beseech your grace, let me the knowledge of my fault bear with me, if with myself I hold. I think, actually, my very, very first speech that I did when I went to the Royal Shakespeare Company was I played Celia in As You Like It, and Celia is Rosalind's cousin. Hmm. And Rosalind's very sad at the beginning of the play, but Celia tries to cheer her up. And she has an amazing speech that is fundamentally a syllogism. She says, "Herein I see thou lovest me not with the full weight that I love thee," which is the title of the speech, as it were. Mm-hmm. If thy uncle, my banished father, had banished thy uncle, the Duke, my father, so thou hadst still been with me, I could have taught my love to take thy father for mine. So wouldst thou, if the truth of my love to me were so righteously tempered as mine is to thee. Now, I've garbled it, but in a way it's saying, you know, if I was in your position, I wouldn't feel the way you do because I would know that I loved you. So it's got that kind of philosophical twisting of words. And I think in that way it was useful to have been to university. I was miserable at the time because I thought I was too old at drama school. I was 21 when I went to RADA.
But, too old.
I know, but God, old to be 21.
Right.
But it did also mean that I didn't actually have to go and earn my living as an actress till I was 23. So I had a very, very good, you know, solid education before I took
off. Well, and clearly it helped you with memorization and text staying with you, because that was not the other day and you have it with you, right? We're not in the same room, but I know you don't have that in front of you, and everyone should know that is something that is in your mind and in your heart, because it's clearly you've connected with that. How do you... When you are doing some big speech, or when you're doing The Wasteland, the T.S. Eliot poem that you perform, which is at least a half hour long, is that correct?
Mm-hmm. 40 minutes, yeah.
40 minutes.
Yeah.
So you're reciting something, and you've done it over the years. Does that text just live inside of you? Do you have to go back to it? Like, how do you go back to these texts, and where do they live in you? I forget lyrics like a day after I finish it. How do you remember these words over the years?
Well, the cruel truth of time is that anything I've learned recently, I forget.
Right.
I did Happy Days, Beckett's Happy Days, some time ago, and I can't remember much of that. Of course, it's a very hard text to remember because it never finishes a sentence. It's all that day. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, strange fragments of thoughts. But I'm a great believer in the thing of by heart, because it's not by your head that you learn it, but really by your heart. And something like The Wasteland, you know, it's full of images. You know, the chair she sat in, like the burnished throne, glowed on the marble. Well, that's a quotation from Antony Cleopatra. The chair she sat on, like a burnished throne. And it's also a chair, and it's also like a burnished throne. So you get to see things, you know, other withered stumps of time were shown upon the walls, staring forms leaned out, hushing the room enclosed. You get to see the thing that you're talking about. So when it's concrete images, I just play very deeply with really painting them in my mind, and then I see them, and then I have them,
wow.
And the words follow.
And they stay with you.
They do. Or there's another wonderful bit of The Wasteland where two women are chatting in a pub, you know.
Yeah.
And one says, when Lil's husband was demobbed, I said, I didn't mince my words. I said to myself. And then the barman says, hurry up, please. It's time. Now, Albert's coming back. You make yourself a bit smart. What did you do with that money he gave you to get yourself some teeth? He did. I was there. You've mauled out, Lil. And get a nice set, he said. I swear I can't bear to look at you and no more, can't I? So, you know, there are people speaking. And once you've got the joy of them speaking,
yeah.
It's very easy to remember them.
Yeah. You know what story you're telling. And it,
you
it
do.
Stays
you know
the
story
you're
telling. Yeah.
That's incredible.
So it takes time. I mean, it's not that on day one this happens. You know, it does take oodles of time. And I think somebody wrote or said very interestingly about people who are talented at something. It is not that they're more talented than the next person, but they're talented enough to be willing to spend the time on the thing.
Right.
You know, I think painters take a long time to paint a good picture, but they're willing to spend the time at that canvas. And I think it's the same with musicians. You know, they still have to practice scales the same as the rest of us.
Right.
But they're willing to put the time in. So the 10,000 hours, I think, does work. Just spend forever at the thing and eventually it'll go into your bones.
It seems to me like your background, especially growing up in a home full of music, probably really helped you too. Because it, to me, when I'm approaching any kind of Shakespeare and especially in verse, I hear the song. You know, there's something in it that helps me remember it because I can hear the notes in my head, even though they're not written out.
Yes. I think a song, of course, is much easier to learn. It also has often got very good rhyme.
Right.
And you don't always have rhyme. Even in Shakespeare, you don't always have rhyme.
Mm-hmm.
But you do have, you know, verse. I mean, verse is an amazing thing because verse, certainly the iambic pentameter of verse of Shakespeare, which goes ti-tum, 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 you know. You see me, Lord Bassanio, where I stand, such as I am, though for myself alone, I would not be ambitious in my wish. So you always have that little pulse going on underneath. So you try not to obviously act the pulse or people would die of boredom. But that pulse does mean that you're always going up, down, up, down, up, down, up, down, up, down. Unless, of course, Shakespeare is so brilliant that he sometimes reverses that and gives you the alternative syncopation beat. So the witches in Macbeth don't go ti-tum, ti-tum. They go tum-ti, tum-ti. When shall we three meet again? In thunder, lightning, or in rain? When the hurly-burly's done? When? So the stress is on the first beat.
Right.
But he'll always give you the clue of what he's doing. That's the good thing. So you always know.
There's a map from him.
There's a map. There's a real map. And that's why people say, you know, study the map. Really take it seriously. And then something marvelous happens, alchemically happens, so that if you learn the same speech, Rory, as I'm learning, we both say to be or not to be, that is the question. You learn it and I'll learn it, but the audience hearing you speak it and me speak it, there will be something different because you will approach it, even if you approach it the same as me, something about the bit of you that's you will come through the thing. And the same, maybe that's the same in song, you know, if somebody sings something, the more rigorous they are with the truth, with the outside truth of it, the more their own internal self will be revealed.
Wow.
That's the miracle of it, actually.
Right. You left RADA and went on to perform and work with the Royal Shakespeare Company and the National Theater. And you did some wonderful roles there, including Rosalind. You've done Mother Courage. You've done some great roles. But one of the most famous ones, challenges that you've taken on is Richard II taking on one of the history plays. Can you talk a little bit about taking on a male role and what that was like?
Well, of course, now it's become very popular, but this was 20 years ago. And oddly, Deborah Warner, who had directed a lot of the plays I'd been in, she directed Hedda Gabler, The Good Press of Sichuan, and Electra. And we were really on a roll at that stage. The National asked us to do something. And we looked for Shakespeare's, but I'd already played a lot of the heroines at the Royal Shakespeare Company in my 20s, the Beatrice, the Portias, you know, the Rosalinds, the Celias. And everybody said, you should play Hamlet. And you think, well, I thought Hamlet is a play about a man and his mother. I didn't really think that I could bring anything to it other than invading the male space of it. But Richard II is about a girly boy. It's a kind of a boy who doesn't think of himself as a boy, really. He thinks of himself as a sort of god.
Right.
And
right.
I felt that was a more neutral part I could take on. So I took on Richard II. In fact, I found it very, very hard. And I found it hard for the following reason, is that something about acting, even if you're playing verse and you're just being true to it, as I suggested earlier, you are always playing from your own personal history, your childhood. And Richard II is very much about a person who was made king very young, age 9 or 10, and whose cousin, Bolingbroke, who later takes over, right, of course, the throne, the rumor had it that they were playing together when the news came that Richard II was king. And Bolingbroke, his much more butch playmate, had to kneel to this young prince. So in the private sphere, Bolingbroke was the stronger, but in the public sphere, Richard was the stronger.
Wow.
And that was a very big inspiration to us when we were doing it, that there was a tension between the private relationship at home with Bolingbroke and then the public relationship of this defiant cousin who then finally rises and takes over from Richard. So it's a marvelous play about a person who's too big for their boots and who discovers that it doesn't matter whether you're a man, I nor no man, you know, unless you discover how you have to be nothing.
Wow.
You know, let me sit upon the ground and tell sad stories of the death of kings. He's full of irony, he's full of intelligence, but he's full of that sort of myopic self-importance that we witness so obviously now in the people trying to bring on Brexit in England. A sort of idealized self-mythologizing, and he discovers that actually you have to be human. So he has an interesting journey in the play, whilst meanwhile having to give up the thing he loves most, which is the crown. So it's full of mourning and sorrow, the play, even though politically you could not be on his side.
Yeah. Was there a lot of controversy around a woman playing a historical figure?
The really terrible thing was before we even opened, you know, there was lots of sniding about it in the press. And I think at that time, it was because for a lot of the English consumer and theatre goer, and indeed the institution of the theatre, they thought of the history plays as history of England. In fact, Shakespeare just makes plays out of the history of England. He's not, the theatre rules are much more important than the history. And, you know, the French had no such problems. Ariane Mnuchin had done a Richard II. And the French had no problems with people chopping the heads off kings, because that's what they did with their kings. But in England, there is still a sense of the divine right of kings, and maybe the divine right of men to be kings, and maybe the divine right of girls not to play them. So it was very controversial at the time. I mean, the argument about my playing Richard II would now be ironed out in a second, wouldn't even be noticed.
Right.
But at that time, it caused huge controversy, which I hated, because I, like a lot of actors, just want to be admired for doing it really well.
Yeah.
I hated being punished for having transgressed. But in the event, of course, it became quite a historic play and production, and the production was beautiful, and
yes,
it went to Paris, and it was a huge hit there, and it also went to the Salzburg Festival, where it was much hailed. So it found its place in Europe, perhaps almost more than it did in England.
Wow. I want to talk about that a little bit more, about having, you know, this outside controversy, or, you know, I was just talking with a friend about reviews, and when you're in a TV or a film and it gets reviewed, maybe you read it and you can choose to or not, but it doesn't affect your performance because that's already happened. When you're on stage, if you are opening night, you read those reviews, whether they're good or bad, they can get in your head. I can imagine that a controversy like that, you know, or people saying you shouldn't be doing it, and then you have to go on stage and deliver the story. How do you keep that out of your mind and stay present when you're on that stage?
Well, you've picked a very good moment for asking that, because at that time, we had done three productions, Hedda Gabler and The Good Person, as I mentioned, and Electra. And they had had huge success, these plays. And the Richard II, in some ways, by some critics, I was absolutely hammered, as though I though I'd forgotten what acting was or something, which I hadn't. It has nothing to do with the skill of the, or just the practice. I mean, of course you can be, you know, good in one thing and bad in another, but I didn't think we were particularly bad in it. But so I think bias had literally come in, but it's, I read two of these reviews and I had to go to bed. I was so, I felt absolutely, I had to put the blankets over my head. And I didn't know how I was going to find the strength to perform the rest. From that day on, I never read a theatre review.
Is that right?
Yeah. And it was the only thing because I literally couldn't contain the vitriol in my head and perform it. Because you're also, you know, you're being daring if you're doing an experiment. You're trying to experiment. You're not, you're trying to do something you don't know how to do, or you don't know how that you can do. So I'm terribly proud I did it now and terribly proud at the time, subsequently, but at the moment of it, it was excruciating. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you should be. It is successful, and you know, I think it really did change the way that we see casting. And you know, now you look at, you know, even Hamilton, a huge success on Broadway, which is, you know, all these white men being played by people of all different backgrounds, and I think that, you know, casting can be part of the storytelling without saying a word. And I completely understand that now of you explaining that Richard II, this was a king that people had a hard time kneeling to because of his physical stature, or, you know, who he was. How, you know, that's difficult for people to do to women now, you know, and it's this part of the story that we're living in now. And I think
Richard II, you know, he wrote a cookbook, and also he was keen on peace. And of course, most countries want leaders who want war. And one is quite a feminine sort of, he had a feminine attitudes, you know, he was feminine. Yeah.
God, that's what we need. We need more feminine attitudes.
I don't know if you do, but that was certainly my justification for the playing of it. It wasn't some arbitrary, you know, it was very much about not wasting. A lot of men have to waste a lot of energy trying to be effeminate playing Richard II. So I didn't have to do that bit.
Right. Well, you had such wonderful success on the stage in London. And of course, TV and film came calling. You had a wonderful part in the Oscar award-winning movie My Left Foot with Daniel Day-Lewis. Was that your first big moment on screen?
Well, I mean, big moment. It didn't seem big at the time. I was doing I was at Stratford, and I was doing the Tammy the Shrew, I think, at the Barbican. And I went to Dublin and met Daniel and Jim Sheridan, and they asked me to be in it. And I was thrilled. I don't think I'd ever been in a film. So I really was excited. But I was so recently processed through the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, rather.
Right.
So I was so keen on the stage. I didn't really take film that seriously, but I loved being in that film. And that film was begun with a credit card because we hadn't even got the funding. So it was the tiniest film in the world, or so it seemed at that second, that first week.
Right.
And then I remember going to a dinner with Daniel with Granada Television, because they were, we were having a dinner with them and the producers to try and encourage them to give money, and they did, and they underpinned it. And of course, the rest is history. And Daniel made his name brilliantly in that film. So again, you know, in hindsight, it was a huge moment. But at the time, it was just a small film. But it did a very good thing for me in that. That autumn, I was again back at Stratford and Avon in a play called, I think I was doing The Shrew again, or I was doing, I was doing a James Shirley comedy written in the 17th century. And I was being looked at by Bob Rafelson from Mountains of the Moon. And I remember I was acting away one evening, and half of Hollywood walked in and watched half the play, and they left.
That sounds about right.
But they all stormed in looking amazing with their sort of Californian tans, you know, tans. And then they all sat in the front row and they watched very nicely, and then they left.
They might have thought it was over, you know, that they were not used to intermissions at the movies.
They just saw what they wanted. They went to dinner. And sure enough, I was cast. But I think they were allowed to see tiny footage from my left foot, and that's why I was cast in Mounts of the Moon. So I'm very grateful to Mounts of the Moon for having to my left foot for having it got me into Mountains of the Moon.
Well, it's you know, I remember being surprised to learn about your dramatic career on the stage, because I was first introduced to you in the film Three Men and a Little Lady, which you are so brilliant in. You are so funny. It's almost like that's like I was, you know, I don't remember how old I was, but I remember watching and thinking, this is a brilliant comedic performance. This is the kind of that's the kind of actor I want to be, the one who comes in and steals the whole thing. What was that movie like? I mean, you know, you certainly weren't cast in that because of playing Medea. How did that happen?
Well, again, I think I was doing, you know, I was doing The Good Press of Such One, I think, at the National. And I was cast in Three Men and a Little Lady. And they made it both in America for the interiors, because Ted Danson wasn't entirely available, I think. I think that was why. And we also made it up in the Cotswolds. And the really wonderful thing about that, it was that I was allowed to do anything I liked in it, really. I mean, I have to say the lines, but yeah. I remember there's a very famous line in it, which is not so splendid as your mighty erections, I imagine, as this woman is looking out at a tent being erected in a garden.
Yeah.
And she says it, and people find that very funny because everything was a double entendre.
Right.
But I remember I wanted to come down the stairs before coming into the room. So I had a very long sense of, I wanted to just come down the stairs, come into the room, and then say it. So I was allowed to do that.
Right.
Emile Ardolino was the man who directed it. Subsequently, he died very sadly and very early in his life. Mm. And he was a charming director who kind of indulged me. And also Tom Selleck, who when we did the seduction scene,
right,
he said, I'll just stand here. You do anything you need to do. So I climbed up on him, tore him down over a sofa. Landed on the ground. And then, you know, Emile said, let's bring the cameras in and we'll shoot that then. So I had great fun playing, you know, being free.
Yeah, that's what it was. It was playing and being free. I remember that performance for all time. It's kind of like the gold standard of what it means to come in and deliver the comedic relief. But for you, going back from drama to comedy, do you see it differently? Is it all just playing? Is it all just storytelling? Or do you find that you have to approach it differently as an actress?
I think I thought that, you know, being maybe from Ireland, that all drama should just be about making people laugh. I think that's what I thought it was. I mean, I really didn't have any theory about it. And then at the end of playing a lot of these heroines at the Royal Shakespeare Company, I was asked to play Electra. And I thought, oh, I'm not sure I want to play, you know, something as sad as Electra.
Right.
But my brother had been killed in a car accident, my youngest brother, 2 years earlier. Mm. And a lot of Electra is about the fact that she misses her brother, who she thinks, and during the play, she hears he's been killed. In fact, he hasn't. That's the whole ruse of the genius of the play, that Orestes is in fact alive, but she thinks he's dead. And I suddenly, you know, very late, and I was 28, I had this burning bush moment of realizing that these plays are profoundly to do with the biography of the person playing them. I mean, you can't map your biography, but you're using the center of yourself.
Right.
And I found that play changed my whole chemistry. I mean, I actually played Three Men and a Lady after that, but I just mean I discovered that tragedy was just as important and isn't about, you know, being shouting or saying, wah, but actually about allowing the vulnerability of someone's profound grief to be the center of their thinking.
Wow.
And I learned a lot on that play, I must say. I did. And then subsequently, when I played Hedda Gabler about 2 years later, there was that element of the tragedy of Hedda Gabler is that she has no courage in herself. So she's actually empty in herself, but she's also very witty on the surface. So, but the point of the play is not that she's witty on the surface. The point of the play is that she's empty. And I don't think I would have discovered one without having done Electra.
Wow. Mm. It's a wonderful gift when you get to perform or be a part of art that actually changes you you know, that affects you as a person. It's rare.
Yeah. It's not easy. You know, it usually comes from a huge amount. I mean, it's easy to talk about it now, but when we were doing Electra, we found it very hard to do. We didn't know how to do it. You kept on finding little rituals and everything that was avoidance, really. And you only find it from just going over it and over it and over it and over it. And then finally something clicks and you think, this is what it is. And it's usually the thing you've been avoiding.
Right. Well, this role might have affected you in a different way, Aunt Petunia in the Harry Potter movies. I'm sure, you know, there's a lot of like kids coming up to you more so than in the past. What was it like to be a part of that phenomenon?
Well, you know, again, you know, this is the medium, isn't it? The fact that a piece that you make in England, set with all the class system, private schooling, everything that we're all trying to legislate against, should have in its basis something so popular that you think, well, it'll be popular in England. And then you find it's also popular in France, where they do not have the same private education system. And then you find it's really popular in China. I mean, it was an absolute global phenomenon, Harry Potter. And it was, you know, of course, a huge privilege to be part of it, because it's the story, as in the books, of empowering children, isn't it? Magic is what children invent in order to make sense of the incomprehensible adult world. And I think J.K. Rowling has caught that empowerment, you know, splendidly, so that finally the children win, don't they?
Right.
And that's really important, because children often don't win.
And it was so fantastic that she was so adamant that all of the actors be British, so that all of the performances were by all of you wonderful stage actors from Britain. I mean, it was incredible to get to watch, you know, who was going to pop up next in the next movie of the series.
I mean, had she not, I have no doubt that the Americans would have cast Americans, wouldn't they?
Paramount
would
for
have cast
sure.
Americans. I'm sure they would. So it was, yes, it was an absolutely fantastic clever, wise sort of precept that she suggested there. I mean, it was just wonderful that we were all in it. We were all in it. We all knew each other.
Yeah. And I think that it also really served the movie here in the States, because it felt more like folklore. Like we were being shown something, not like, oh, this is the person that we've seen in a million movies before. It felt so real, like we were being brought into a world that we'd never been to. I mean,
yes,
you know, of course,
the star of the film is the film.
Yes,
not the star of the film, but the film itself is the star, or the children are the stars, and that's completely correct.
Yeah. So I had the privilege of getting to see you on Broadway in The Testament of Mary, which was absolutely phenomenal performance that you gave on your own, a one-woman show about Mary, the mother of Jesus, and her testament of what happened. It was amazing, but as a raised Catholic Irish, I was very nervous about being struck by lightning by just buying the ticket. What was that like, taking on that role? And of course there were protests of that as well, so you have a lot of controversy around some of these roles you've chosen, huh?
I think, well, I'm glad that you endured it and went in anyway and bought the ticket. Though Colm Tobin, who was brought up a Catholic, you know, meticulously never named this is a mother of a terrorist, as it were, really, who gets crucified. And
right.
So it doesn't take long for you to work out who that chap
right.
might be. But he is meticulous about not kind of giving her a name or anything.
Yeah.
She's just, in fact, nobody ever calls her Mary, I think, in the play, but he calls the title The Testament of Mary. And it's about her. I mean, it's a brilliantly, it turns the New Testament on its head, in that this is a mother who, far from adoring her holy son, finds him an upstart, vain, overly empowered, and can't really get it why things like the wedding feast at Cana, that clearly there was a trick with the wine, and sort of leaves and separates from her very not particularly warm son. And of course he found roots for that in the New Testament, because there's hardly any reference to her at all,
right?
Except that she says, can we do something about the wine, and he says, you know, I must be about my father's business. he's quite cross to her in the New Testament, and that she doesn't really know, she doesn't see him very much. And then Colum had, of course, gone to all the art galleries and looked at the Renaissance paintings, the famous paintings of the Crucifixion, which is a hugely iconic system of painting from the pre-Renaissance, really, to through the Renaissance, where you have the crucifix and you have Jesus on the crucifix and you have various saints and the Virgin at the bottom. And he inverted that instead of staying for her son's death, she ran away because she would have been arrested by the Romans. So it's a side take on that story, and it's much more secular. But I was alone on the stage, but I never think of these plays, if I'm alone, as one-woman shows, in that you're so surrounded by a team that I've worked with over many years. Deborah Warner directed it. It's lit by brilliant lighting designers, and Mel Mercier, who I've worked with a lot, was the music designer on that. So you have a team, you're in a way, you're in reply to everybody else's work on it as well.
Yes, that's very true. But if anything goes wrong, you are only one on that stage. And it was remarkable. But you're right, the design of it and everything about it. There was a vulture on stage, wasn't it?
There was a vulture, yeah. Well, there was a vulture.
I guess it wasn't a one-woman show. It was a woman and a vulture.
A woman and a vulture. I hated that vulture. I can't tell you how much. I'd have the vulture on my arm, but the vulture... You know, I knew I was safe. I was terrified initially of the vulture, but as somebody said to me, as long as you don't die, the vulture won't bite you. You only like red meat. if it was an eagle, it would have been much worse.
Right.
So I walked around with this vulture who, you know, they feed a mouse to, and then it starts sort of coughing up bits of fur balls.
Oh,
it was a really horrible animal. But it had some of the hell-like desolation that is also in many of the paintings of the 16th 17th century and there's a wonderful section in it about the Virgin looking at a man who has a bird in a cage while she's trying to distract herself from the fact that her son is hanging on a cross. So it's a very, very human play about watching your son being tortured, and that's why the vulture was there. But it gets feelings, the wonderful feeling that you don't get in a religious text, because that's just the surface, isn't
right.
it? The dogma of a religious text. You actually get what it might have been like to live in those cruel times.
Right, the humanity of it.
And of course, it was interesting that when you mentioned that there were riots, there were people whipped up against the play, which was really unnecessary, because the play is very respectful to any true Catholic, without it being in any way theological. But on the opening night, Scott Rudin, who is the most magnificent producer in the world, he had the front doors padded so that we wouldn't be able to hear the people rioting outside.
Wow.
He's an amazing person
He is. And I worked with him doing the Book of Mormon. And do you know that there were no protests for the Book of Mormon? And I can't say the same about what we said in that theater. So I think they were at the wrong show. But it's funny. It's just, there are certain things that are taboo, that aren't allowed to be talked about even in art. And sometimes people won't even listen to what you're actually saying. They hear the title. That's it. It's done.
That's
the conversation's over.
Yeah.
I want to know, how do you unwind after a performance like that? Do you have to go straight to bed? Are you, when it's so heavy, how do you take care of yourself after something like that?
Well, I think having been brought up an Irish Catholic, I think never took myself very seriously. And maybe I should have. And I do notice that in the last decade, I do have to take myself more seriously at the end of shows. You know, I used to go out and eat and drink and have chat away for another 3 hours after the show.
Right.
But the most heavy run was this Medea that we had done, that we brought to initially to BAM, the Brooklyn Academy of Music, and then it went on a tour across America, and it's only an hour and a half, but it's a huge role and a huge evening, and very violent, and Jason tries to sort of drown Medea near the end of it, and I still have my head underwater for hours and thought I was drowning, and we came onto Broadway, again much helped by Mr. Rudin, and I found on that, that because the American system is not like the British system, you have a show on a Friday, you have two on Saturday, and you have one on Sunday. By Sunday evening, I was a basket case of exhaustion, and I couldn't do anything. What I used to do is I used to go to the cinema and just kind of watch any film.
Whatever they had.
You know, on the 7 o'clock, so I'd finish at 6:30 or something, and I would just get washed and go out and try and just... But on Monday morning, I was absolutely... Sort of depression would hit me. And I think it was just being worn out, having done this tour and then this run on Broadway. So I think everybody else in the cast had a much better time than I had. I became more and more tired. And, you know, you do get run down. And you usually get sick at the end of the run. That's the famous thing with actors, that you're fine for the run. And Doctor Theatre keeps you healthy. And then you absolutely collapse and get some frightful flu at the end.
It happens to me almost every time. It's crazy. We're going to wrap up here. I'm just so, so delighted to get to talk with you. It really means so much to me. You had a quote in an interview you gave that has kind of stuck with me. You said that theater, and I'm kind of, you know, paraphrasing here, but you said theater just has to be better than a conversation at dinner with friends, which is actually a very high order. And I love that because... That's true. Like at the end of the day, you know, people could just go and talk to their friends and have a meal. And that's, you know, pretty satisfying. We have to present a story that's a little bit more exciting than that gossip they might have over dinner.
Yes, or to stop them leaving the theater. And that's something to do with your heartbeat, I think, is that, you know, when you're with your friend and she or he is telling you a story about what happened yesterday, you know all the characters, you know all the history, and your heart races, and then you go back down, you chat a bit more, and then your heart races, and it calms down. And in the theater, the heartbeat of the performer has got to capture the heartbeat of the people sitting in the audience. And if the person is on stage with their heart racing and the people in the audience are going tick-tock, tick-tock, then, you know, it just isn't happening. So it's really about rhythm, and the rhythm of a chat with a friend, there's nothing more exciting. So the theatre has to work very hard to say, no, this is even more exciting.
Right. I love that. No, I love that. It just simplifies the whole thing of what we're asked to do. You know, why we have to do it. Thank you so much for talking with us. You are so wonderful on Killing Eve, which is on Sunday nights on AMC and the BBC America. It is fantastic. And congratulations on all your success. And I can't wait to see you on a stage again.
Good. I'll come back. Thank you.
Sounds good. You take care, Fiona. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hey guys, thank you so much for listening to the Geffen Playhouse Unscripted with my guest Fiona Shaw. Isn't she just magnificent? I am going to listen to this episode a few times. There's so much to learn from what that woman has to say. Please remember to subscribe, rate, and review the podcast and tell your friends. Tell your friends the kind of conversations we're having here at the Geffen Playhouse Unscripted. Thank you so much and see you next time.
Thanks for listening to Geffen Playhouse Unscripted. Be sure to download new episodes every month right here on Podcast One, on the Podcast One app, or on Apple Podcasts. And don't forget to rate, review, and share.
Check out Shenanigans with Sheena Shea every Tuesday on Podcast One.
Shout out right here.
Everyone's favorite from Vanderpump Rules shares juicy stories from behind the bar with amazing guests.
And I was like, hello. And she goes, oh, hi, Derek. Good morning. And I was like, am I Derek? I thought I had turned into a guy named Derek.
Check out Shenanigans with Sheena Shea at Podcast One and Apple Podcasts.